I will turn this back on. I've before forgotten. And then you have this on to get the recordings, which, by the way, in about a week, all the seminars plus the plenaries will be up online. So you can actually go and listen to them. Before, you used to get a thumb drive, which you purchased at the end of the week, but now they decided to make it available to everybody and just put up online. So this talk will be up online. But in addition to being able to get the audio of this talk, if you'd like to get the PowerPoint for it, there's a clipboard at the back. You can sign up, and signing up will keep you informed of things that the Institute for Credible Christianity is doing. That's what I'm a member of. So I'll send you that PowerPoint. Plus, this last week, I finished an essay on the topic of why does God want to limit our sex lives, and I'll send that to you as well. That's a much longer essay than this is, with very lengthy footnotes, but it's been fascinating to me surfing the web and seeing studies that have been done on the implications of young people having sex and how early they have sex and how early in a relationship and what kind of effect that has on the relationship. And one of the things, the key thing out of the talk today, is that the secular studies actually provide a strong foundation for believing that the Christian view of sexuality, and that you should wait until marriage and that the sex should be just within marriage, actually makes very good sense. Not just on Christian terms, but on just general terms. But we'll get back to that. Again, my wife, Janet, is back here. I mentioned earlier that we have a board meeting later on today. Dave Burns, who is the MC, is one of our board members, so we have our board meeting here. So the topic for today is understanding biblical sexuality, or the original title was, Why Does God Want to Limit Our Sex Lives? And Jeremy said, you know, we can tone that down a little bit. You know, understanding of the why of biblical sexuality isn't quite as racy. It's true, but the talk I've given it for non-Christian audiences, basically. And so having more racy topics, sort of, you know, okay, why would God be so? so it works well in that kind of a setting. What I want you to do right now is turn the person next to you, and this quote, if someone were to say this to you, how would you respond? So this is the quote. The Christian sexual ethic of sex only in marriage is an ethic that used to make sense. It made sense because having sex entailed the serious possibility that a woman might get pregnant. And it is important that children be born into a setting where they'd be wanted and cared for by parents. But with effective birth control, the sex only in marriage ethic no longer makes sense. So if you're just walking in, I want you to turn to someone near you and talk about this, maybe two or three people together. How would you respond to someone saying this to you? So it's on the board if you just walked in. So turn to someone near you, and how would you respond to that comment? Welcome. This is the sexuality talk.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, 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 fine. That's fine. Yes, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah, come on in. What we're doing right now is we're discussing the statement and how you respond to this kind of a statement. Okay, well, it could go on for a while, but what are some of the thoughts that you had or expressed as you were talking to the person next to you? Emotional consequences, not just is a baby going to come along, there's emotional consequences. You want to elaborate on what you mean by their emotional consequences?
Getting attached to a person and then maybe moving on to somebody else, getting attached to
Right, right. So, yeah.
Re-say it.
Okay, so the comment for the recording is there's emotional attachment which is there. And if people have an emotional attachment, break that off and have sex with somebody else, there's an emotional attachment. And something is lost in that process. So each time, yeah. Right, right. So we'll come back to more of that in terms of the study. It's interesting to me that when there's a major study was done, and they asked two questions that were identical except for the age was given. One was, do you think it's okay for 18-year-olds to have sex with one another if they have a deep affection for one another? And a majority of American adults, said, yes, that's okay. But if you ask the question for 16-year-olds, it's less than half of that. So people have a lot of reservations about a 16-year-old having sex. 18-year-olds, okay, but 16-year-old, well, why is it that makes such a difference? I mean, there's sort of this, well, sex isn't really all that trivial. And are 16-year-olds mature enough to be able to do this? Now, they think the 18-year-olds are. I'm not quite sure that it was really that big a difference between 16, but there's something about, so this number of 18, when you become 18, then you're really an adult. 16, you're adolescent. 18, you're an adult, and you can make those kind of decisions. But the fact that there's significant reservations for two years earlier says that, no, it's not just, you know, biological function that's fun. There's some serious consequences involved in it. Anybody else? Responses to this comment?
Physical consequences.
Physical consequences. How so?
Yeah,
so there's lots of diseases, and interesting enough, most young people don't take that seriously. They don't realize the significant dangers that they're putting themselves in. And if you have sex with multiple people, obviously your risk add up by the more opportunities you get these diseases, which will then affect you for much of your life, because typically they're not things that just kind of you can get a shot and get over it, but it has to be something that's controlled. Anybody else?
Build up a tolerance, get bored.
Yeah, so you need more of a punch next time. And if you're, yeah. And it may well be when you do get married, this person may not be quite as scintillating in sex as someone earlier. So yeah, there's consequence to that. Okay, those are good responses. I need to start off by saying that when you address this topic, there needs to be just tons of grace. A lot of people are involved in it. Some of them feel guilty about it, some don't. But at the same time, when you talk about it, you're talking a sensitive issue that touches a nerve with people, and you really need to have a great deal of grace. And let me say at this point, in the past, you see people say, well, if you're a virgin, that's what really counts. You lose your virginity, you've lost it. Forget it. Your opportunity has passed. But no, it's not just being a virgin, not being a virgin, but actually stopping. If you're having sex with someone else and you stop, there's real benefit in stopping and waiting. So you shouldn't think that you've lost it if you've already lost your virginity. And so it's important to have a great deal of grace and sensitivity in talking to people, because this is just a very strongly emotionally laden issue. Jesus, remember, when the woman caught adultery, and it doesn't appear as though that's part of the actual original Gospel of John, but most scholars take seriously, it certainly fits with Jesus and could easily be an encounter that Jesus had. This woman is caught in adultery, and they say, should we stone her? And Jesus says to them, those of you without sin, cast the first stone. And they all walk away. And Jesus says to the woman, does no one condemn you? And she says, no. And then Jesus says, neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more. So it's not approving, but at the same time, Jesus is expressing grace towards this woman who has been caught in the act of adultery. A conviction that I have is that God's rules and God's commands are not arbitrary. In other words, God doesn't make rules for us just to see if we're willing to forego things we want, to see if we'll be obedient. Rather, God's commands are actually God that reflects the goodness of God, and he gives us these commands because they're for our good. And if that's the case, then one should expect that when God gives this command of sex only in marriage, that actually it's not an arbitrary command, but it's for our good. If that's so, then we should be able to think about it. We're not guaranteed that we will see things as God sees it. And it's not always the case that we can see through God's commands and understand, well, this is why it's good that God does this. But generally speaking, one can, and one can reflect about this and ask, well, how is it the case that in fact adhering to this command contributes to human flourishing? Not just flourishing for Christians, but human flourishing in general. So that's a conviction that I have, which pursues me to think more about it. I want to just give a statement here, sort of upfront, the statement about how I view the biblical view of sexuality. I'm not going to be elaborating a biblical view of sexuality, but here's a short statement. Sex is solely to be within the marital bond that unites a man and a woman in a lifelong love that brings them together into a complementary whole, a whole that reflects the union of Christ with his church and that provides a setting within which children can be raised and receive the complementary nurturing of a father and a mother. So I've said a lot there, sort of a nutshell, but that's kind of how I understand the biblical understanding of sex. But then this question, okay, why? Why be restrictive in this way? So when I'm giving this talk, I give four non-religious reasons. Now, there are Christian reasons why, in fact, you should adhere to it. But I'm going to focus my attention today on non-religious reasons, reasons that don't assume the person believes the Bible, doesn't assume the person has any Christian faith whatsoever. And the first one is oxytocin. Oxytocin is a hormone that's released in the brain on a variety of occasions and has a powerful effect upon us. Sometimes when I'm asked the question, well, what's wrong with having sex just for the fun of it, if both parties agree to that? And what's wrong with that? The one-word answer I give is oxytocin. The reason why oxytocin is the one-word reason why it's not good to have sex for the fun of it is that you may intend to have sex for the fun of it, and if, in fact, it's just a one-night stand, you probably won't develop very much of an emotional connection with that person. But if you have multiple sexual encounters with that same person, even though you intended it just to be for the fun of it, an emotional bond develops, and oxytocin is a biochemical, it's a hormone that's released when we're having an affection with other people, but it's released very strongly in the lead up to sex and the act of sex itself. Here's a statement about oxytocin from Psychology Today website. What is oxytocin? Oxytocin is a powerful hormone. When we hug or kiss a loved one, oxytocins drive up. It also acts as a neurotransmitter in the brain. In fact, the hormone plays a huge role in pair bonding. Prairie voles, one of nature's most monogamous species, produce oxytocin in spades. This hormone is also greatly stimulated during sex, birth, breastfeeding, and the list goes on. So oxytocin, the effect that it has on your brain, is it builds an emotional bond with a person that you're in this relationship with. So if you're having sex with a person, you may have wanted it just to be for the fun of it, but in fact, you find an emotional bond develops, and when you break it off, it hurts. You didn't intend that to be the case, but it happens. Now, it happens that women have about twice as much oxytocin released as men do. So women are more strongly affected by men, but also men are affected by it. So when there's a breakup, don't think it's only the woman that feels emotional hurt at the breakup. The guy also feels emotional breakup with the breakup. But it's felt more strongly with women. There's more oxytocin which is released. There is a movie that I haven't seen called Vanilla Sky. Tom Cruise is the main character, and he's basically a playboy sleeping around, and he has sex with a woman and then drops her. And the woman says to him, "Don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not?" Very interesting comment to come in a very secular film. But basically saying, when you have sex, there's something biologically, chemically, which's happening in your body is making a promise, even if you don't. So we're wired such that when we have sex, biologically, the immediate response is to build a bond, so there'd be some fidelity that goes along with the act of having sex. So your body is making a promise, even if you don't. It's a way of talking about the effects of that. The next point is there are two ideas that are very common, which actually are in tension with one another. One is it's okay to have sex for the fun of it before marriage, or maybe if it's not just for the fun of it, it's okay to have sex with someone that you like a lot, you know, a special friend. And it's okay to have sex with a variety of people. But the second belief is once you get married, then you only have sex with your spouse. You don't have sex with other people. Well, the problem with this is that when you get married, your brain doesn't just switch from singleness mode to married mode. Your habits, your expectations, your temptations are all there. It's true something has changed and now you're married, but you shouldn't think that your past habits and your past life just disappear. Now, if in fact you've been sleeping around with a variety of people before you get married, it's going to be harder for you to resist temptations afterwards. So if in the past you said yes when the temptation arose, in the future when the temptation arose, you're more likely to say yes. Plus, it builds problems in the relationship, which we'll come to in just a little bit. And if you ask what is more important in terms of your welfare, is it finding a person that you're married to and you have a successful marriage? Or is it having these years of transition when you can play around? Now, what's more important for the long-term, your long-term well-being? Well, I think it's actually, most people would say, actually, it's quite clear that the longer-term relationship is far more important than these years when you might play around. And if you're playing around now, it makes it more difficult to achieve the longer-term successful marriage that you want. You're basically you're going for short-term gratification at the expense of long-term well-being. So these two decisions, these two ideas are actually in conflict with one another. And if you're even just an egoist who says, I'll do what's in my own self-interest, it's in your own self-interest to resist this very strong temptation of the moment, because even if you do it and even you don't feel any guilt about it and you enjoy it, it's actually going to have negative effects on your longer-term well-being. So therefore, if you're a rational person who wants to increase your own sense of your own well-being, you forego the short-term gratification for the longer-term gain. Another reason is that there's this need within society for strong controls on sex. And I'm going to ask, well, why is that? I mean, why should society care whether two people are in an intimate relationship and they're having sex with each other in their bedroom? If one sets aside sort of moral considerations, just as from a practical standpoint, why should that be of great interest to the state? It's not obvious to me that the state should have any great interest about that. But the state does have an interest in children growing up to be emotionally stable individuals who can become good citizens. So it's very important for society, it's very important for the state to do what they can to improve the nurture of children so the next generation society will be functioning well and these people can become good citizens. But part of what contributes to children growing up well is that they are growing up where they have parents who care for one another. Now, a single parent can still do a decent job in parenting, but it's really ideal to have two parents who really love each other and care for them, and if that continues, the children grow up in a much more stable relationship, but if a divorce doesn't take place, that also helps in the emotional stability of the children. So for the sake of children growing up to be the kind of people that society wants, the state actually has an interest in whether two people are acting in ways which are going to increase the chances of stability there and loving each other. If they're having sex with people apart from marriage, that undercuts, that builds emotional bonds with other people, that undercuts the marriage. So actually society, even though it may not have directly an interest in what adults are doing in their bedroom, it has a strong interest in what children do, and because of that, it also has a strong interest in parents actually holding to this fidelity with each other for the sake of the children. So society sees there's a strong need for sexual controls, and if, in fact, playing around is going to hurt the marriage relationship, is going to hurt the children, then society ought to do what it can to encourage people not to play around. I don't see our society doing that. I don't see our educational system doing that. But actually, I think there's a very good reason for why the state should try to encourage. I don't think that, you know, the state should be penalizing, having laws which you're, if you commit adultery, you go to prison or something like that. But nonetheless, I think the state ought to be doing things which it can to improve the relationship between a husband and a wife, and that they try to see what they can to help that improve in its stability. And part of that is discouraging this play around mode before we get married. So the negative personal impact on casual sex is related to how a person's responding and also how the relationship. If you're in a relationship or the relationship sours, that has a negative effect on you, as well as having a negative effect on the couple. And it's important to ask, apart from what people would just say and giving reasons for and against. So there's reasons, the good things you can get. People say, oh, have sex, it's pleasurable, it's fun. And as Christian, I would say, no, here's some reasons not. Actually, what do studies tell us in terms of the effects of the sexual relationships? What are the effects of the sexual revolution on our society today? So I want to start off with a study that was done in 2010, published in the Journal of Family Psychology, and I was reading a report on it in WebMD. And the title of the WebMD article was Benefits in Delaying Sex Until Marriage. Happier marriages, more satisfying sex among the perks, study finds. All right? And the study involved 2,035 married participants. The majority of them, it said, had sex within the first 2 months of starting to date. Okay, I know a lot of people start having sex early, but the majority of dating couples they were looking at started having sex within the first 2 months. That's sort of where things have gone these days. 16% delayed intercourse until marriage. According to the study, people who waited until marriage rated sexual quality 15% higher than people who had premarital sex. Rated relationship stability 22% higher. Rated satisfaction with their relationships 20% higher. Now, that's not hugely higher, but that's significant, quite significant. And then it goes on to say, the benefits were about half as strong for couples who became sexually active later in their relationships before marriage. So early in relationship is the first 2 months. If you waited and had after that, say you waited 6 months and then started having sex, the negative consequences are much less than if you had sex early on. But there's still negative consequences compared to if you wait to get married. That's the best outcome. The study shows that couples who wait until marriage are happier with the quality of sex than couples who have intercourse before their vows. What's more, couples who delay sex until their wedding night have more stable and happier marriages than couples who have premarital sex. Now, this doesn't say that everyone who's had premarital sex will fail to have a stable marriage. I mean, there are obviously people who do that, do have a stable marriage. But saying statistically, you're putting your future relationship at risk by what you're doing now. The study author, Dean Busby, quote, regardless of religiosity, waiting helps the relationship form better communication processes, and these help improve long-term stability and relationship satisfaction. And I think he's interpreting the data. So I don't think the data says that better communication is what lies behind this difference. But he sees better communication as being a key thing. So people who are in a physical relationship with each other, that tends to dampen the quality of communication and the frequency of communication. Plus, I would add that if you're asking, is marriage going to be a good thing? You need to find out how you are in a relationship with each other without this overlay of emotional bond that develops through having sex. When you're having sex, yes, an emotional bond will develop. Does that mean that you're fit for each other? No, it doesn't. And if you don't have sex, you don't have this emotional bond to the physical side of it, and you can actually get to know the person and have a much better foundation for knowing, is this a good person to marry? All right. The professor I noticed was a professor at Brigham Young University. And if I were sort of a critic, I'd say, he's a Mormon. This study might be biased. It happens that this study is not a study that stands by itself. So even though there's bias, when a person does a well-done study and asks the questions right, the data they get or data they get, doesn't matter what the person wanted who made the study, if they're accurate in reporting it. But nonetheless, there can be some suspicions. But no, there are other studies that give the same kind of results. There's a 2012 study, again in the Journal of Family Psychology, done by Cornell University. And it was reported in the Cornell Chronicle, the university paper, December 19th, 2012. And in that Cornell Chronicle article, they wrote, women who have sex early in a relationship are more likely to be dissatisfied with the quality of the relationship. Men who delayed sex also reported higher levels of commitment and less conflict, but the effect was greater for women. Early sex in a relationship was also associated with living together sooner and less satisfying marriages. So again, sex early on, bad. Later on, better. If you wait until you get married, those are the best outcomes. The lead author of this study, Sharon Sassler, wrote, regardless of the causes, sex early on in a relationship may have lasting effects on the quality of that relationship. Now, the next study I look at is 2014, entitled Before I Do. It was done by the National Marriage Project, which first started off in Rutgers and then shifted over to the University of Virginia. And this study was done at the University of Virginia and reported in the campus paper, The Cavalier Daily. It's a longitudinal study, which means you start off with a group of people and you ask some questions, and then you come back to them sometime later, in this case, 5 years later, and you re-interview them. And then you see, okay, what's happened and what's transpired. And his focus was on the effect of one versus multiple sexual relationships in marriage in the future. So it wasn't looking at people who didn't have sex with anybody, but people who were in a sexual relationship. Let's come back to them 5 years later and see what's transpired. So between 2007 and 2008, close to 1,300 unmarried Americans who were in a relationship and between the ages of 18 and 34 were recruited for the study. Through the next 5 years, 418 of the recruited individuals were married. So they were in a sexual relationship with each other, but one out of three ended up marrying each other. According to the study, men and women who had premarital sex with only their future spouse, so they only had sex with the person they were with then, and they married that person, and their future spouse reported having a stronger relationship than those who did not. Additionally, women who had fewer sexual partners prior to marriage reported having higher marriage quality. So the more partners you have before you get married, the more the negative effect. If you simply have sex with one and you stay with that person, you marry that person, of the people they're studying, that's the best outcome. And again, it's starting off with people who are already sexually active. Then they add the order in which couples move through relationship stages, such as cohabitation or having children, can also impact marriage success. According to the study, those who unintentionally cross these relationship milestones have lower marriage quality than couples who decide on their relationship sequence together. Question, yes?
I find it interesting. Those who unintentionally cross these lines, what do they mean by that? Accidentally had intercourse? Or?
Yeah, it's you didn't intend to have a child, but lo and behold, the woman. Well, okay, in that case, unintentional is pretty obvious. But even when it comes to you move in with someone, what they mean by unintentional was, is this something you deliberated upon and decided, well, what will be the consequences of this and will this be a good thing? Rather, what oftentimes happens is people are, say, the woman is over at the guy's apartment pretty regularly, and well, why not just stay over there? Or finances, you know, it's cheaper if we do this. We could share the cost if we do it. So you're not really thinking very much about it. You sort of slide into it.
So it's not.
It's not accidental.
Discussing, let's move in together. It's just we ended up living together.
Yeah. So it wasn't something that deliberated. Said, what will the consequences of this be? But no, why not? So they just impulsively do it, or they do it for pragmatic reasons or for convenience reasons. So it turns out that most people who move in together are not actually moving together thinking they may eventually get married. They're just doing it for convenience. So they sort of slide into that. I mean, they've been sleeping together, you know, why not stay together? It'd be cheaper. Now, that's called the inertia effect. For quite a while, the studies consistently indicated that if you lived with someone, the chances of having that relationship turn into a good marriage relationship were significantly lower. All right, so it's called the cohabitation effect. And one of the thoughts is that when you move in with a person, it becomes much more difficult to break it off. So in many cases, you keep that relationship going much longer because you're living together than if you were dating. If you're dating and not living together, it's much easier to break it off. If you're living together, it's much more difficult. You have to worry about all the moving, the bills, all those kinds of commitments that you've made. So what ends up is that relationship tends to last much longer than it would have if it weren't for the fact that they're living together, and also pushes things towards marriage. So many people find themselves, well, I guess we should get married, but they really don't have the basis for it. Plus, when they're living together, there's not a clear commitment to each other. There's negative effect on their relationship even before, say, marriage takes place. They've done more recent studies indicate that it's not true that everybody who's cohabitating has equally negative effects. So if two people are, say, engaged, and they're committed to get married when they start living together, the negative effects are much less. I mean, they already have this commitment, they're having sex before they get married. Or even if they're not engaged, but nonetheless they know they want to get married. They haven't told anybody yet, but they know they want to get married, they start living together. They have this commitment to each other, which is clear. But if they move in together and they don't have that commitment, and particularly if one sort of hopes, well, I kind of would like it to work towards marriage, and the other one, no, it doesn't. I know lots of relationships where one person is, I hope we'll get married someday. And the other person has no desire or intention whatsoever to get married. I had a conversation with a friend of mine at the University of Michigan, non-Christian, who was living with his girlfriend, and they were grad students in their mid-20s. And I said to him, I asked him, do you anticipate that you and your girlfriend will eventually get married? He said, maybe we will, maybe we won't, I don't know. And I said to him, given that that's the perspective you have on it, you're actually doing her a grave disservice by continuing this relationship. Now, who am I to sort of, am I not jumping on him as a Christian? I'm simply saying, look, for you to continue the relationship means that when you finish, break off the relationship, say she's 27, you know, it's much harder for her to find a partner. You, as a man, you can go for younger women, but for a woman to marry a man who is significantly younger than herself, and if you're a woman and you have a PhD, it's hard to find a man who wants to marry someone who's academically, educationally far superior to herself. You're doing her a grave disservice by just carrying this on this way. So I was just being blunt with him about what I thought about his continuing this relationship with no commitment on his part. So it turns out that if you're significantly older, the effects on cohabitation are less, and I think that's due to the fact that when you're significantly older, you're taking the longer perspective much more seriously. They said if you take 23-year-olds who start living together at 23, the effects on eventual marriage are much less than if they're living together at 18. So 23 is about the time you're finishing college, you're getting a job, you know. So at that point, your perspective on life is a bit different than when you're a freshman in college, right? But if you're living together while you're in school, the older you are, there's less negative effect. But at the same time, thinking that cohabitation is a good thing is a mistake. In fact, most young people think that if they live together, it will increase the likelihood of a marriage succeeding. They think, well, it's like a test drive. We'll find out whether we're sexually compatible. We find out what it's like we're actually living together. And if it goes well living together, then our marriage will much more likely succeed and much less likely end up in divorce. It turns out that if you live with someone to test the relationship, that's one of the highest risk categories. You can actually enter in a relationship with that in mind, you're actually increasing your risk significantly with that motivation. Even though young people think it's actually going to improve the chances that they won't have, I mean, they'll improve the relationship and the likelihood of divorce will be less. No, it's higher. Okay, there's a book published in 2011, Oxford University Press, called Premarital Sex in America, How Young Americans Meet, Mate, and Think About Marrying by Mark Regeneres and Jeremy Uecker. It was written about in the New York Times. The columnist is Russ Duthat, who's writing about it. He writes, their research, which looks at sexual behavior among contemporary young adults, finds a significant correlation between sexual restraint and emotional well-being. between monogamy and happiness, and between promiscuity and depression. This correlation is much stronger for women than for men. Female emotional well-being seems to be tightly bound to sexual stability, which may help explain why overall female happiness has actually drifted downward since the sexual revolution. I haven't read the book to see how he backs this up, but there are a number of ways in which the position of women has significantly improved since, say, the 1960s, when people typically date the beginning of the sexual revolution. But if, in fact, the sexual revolution has actually caused women's overall happiness to decline, despite the gains which have gotten and achieved, that's not good news for women. Among the young people Regeneris and Euchre studied, the happiest women were those with a current sexual partner and only one or two partners in their lifetime. Virgins were almost as happy, though not quite. And then a young woman's likelihood of depression rose steadily as her number of partners climbed and the present stability of her sex life diminished. It's interesting to me that virgins were almost as happy. I know a lot of women who think, if only I get married, I will be happy. Well, getting married can increase happiness if it's a good marriage. I mean, it's a very good thing, and a marriage for both men and women is good. But if you're not married, whether you're a man or you're a woman, it's not as though your happiness quotient is in the slumps. You actually can have a very rich, fulfilling life, so your happiness isn't quite as great as those who are successfully married. But even if you're not married and would like to be married, your happiness level is just a little bit lower. It's still, you know, quite high. So it's just quite interesting to me that was in there. So what the studies tell us: waiting until marriage is not an old-fashioned idea based on the danger of unwanted pregnancy. Opting for short-term pleasure now is likely to have a negative effect on long-term happiness for oneself, for the couple. Even if one eventually marries the sexual partner, the premarital sex can have a negative effect on the marriage relationship. So I'd actually encourage you, if you know people, say Christians, who are engaged to get married and living together, or having sex together, maybe not living, but they're having sex together before, and you discover that, it's actually a good advice to them to say, it would be good for you and for your relationship if you choose to stop. Maybe the marriage is, the wedding is 2.5 months down the road. If you stop and don't have sex until your wedding night, there will be a couple of major benefits from it. One, your wedding night will be much more significant. It's not, I just had sex with you 5-6 days ago and now we're having sex again. No, it actually means something because you have abstained, you've waited these 2.5 months. And also communicate something. Now that we're having sex, by having sex communicates to you the commitment we've entered into. Even though there was sex before, the choice in waiting gives the power of communication within that act to communicate the bond which is there. Plus, it builds trust in the relationship. So if one of the spouses is on a business trip and there's sexual temptation for a man, it might be some of the woman coming around and soliciting, or for a woman, it might be some old boyfriend that she sees. If, in fact, you know that your spouse had this discipline of waiting until you got married, even though you had sex before, that builds trust in the relationship. So not all is lost simply because you made some bad decisions, I would say, in having sex earlier on. If, in fact, you choose to stop, you can get significant benefit from that. And there's significant healing that Christ can bring into people's lives, regardless of what their past is, no matter what it's like. It's not as though the consequences disappear. But one should recognize that when I start acting in God's way, even though it doesn't completely remove the past, there's significant healing which can take place. So don't despair, depending on what your particular situation is. There are some benefits in waiting. So communication wasn't actually the result of the study, but the professor, Dean Busby, was suggesting that communication was a significant part of why people who delay having sex have better relationships. But here's some that are part of that. Physical expression of affection and love can express the growing love and commitment. So as your relationship develops, not just some of the sexual act itself, but the different things that you do, the ways of the physical affection you show, if the physical affection is really showing the strength of that relationship, it communicates. But if you get into, you know, suppose you're not going to bed with each other, But nonetheless, you're doing a lot of heavy petting and all that kind of stuff, but you're not serious about marriage. What if that's not communicating anything? If, in fact, you have restraint inside, which sort of pace things along, your physical relationship can communicate in powerful ways, in significant ways, as that relationship grows. Physical expressions of affection, not just sex, can push the relationship too fast. When Janet and I were dating, we weren't lovey-dovey in a sort of, you know, by modern standards, but nonetheless, I felt as though what we were expressing through physical affection was stronger than where I was personally. I didn't know whether I wanted to get married, and yet I'm building a relationship which seems to be sort of moving potentially in that direction. So what am I communicating? I mean, what am I communicating by this? Is it just I like her a lot? Or is it that I'm willing to let this relationship continue to grow? So we need to think about how that, and when you get engaged, when you're engaged in a physical relationship, even if it's not sex, and you get into the lovey-dovey kind of mode, you're typically not talking about serious things together. So the extent to which you can hold off on that and actually encourage the doing things together and talking together more, that's going to do a lot for building the relationship rather than pushing it too fast. Healthy relationship need lots of communication. I've talked about that. Resisting future temptation when one is married is easier. I've talked about that. Trust between husband and wife is enhanced. Again, that's an issue that I've talked about. There's a quote I like from Lauren Winter. I wrote a book called Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. She writes, "Life lived inside the contours of God's law humanizes us and makes us beautiful. It makes us creatures living well in the created order. It gives us the opportunity to become who we are meant to be." I want to say one last thing about sexuality identity. What place does our sexuality have, or engaging in sex, have in our identity as ourselves as persons? And there's a common assumption today that your sexuality and engaging in sex is so much a part of who you are that not to act on it is to deny who you are and live less than a fully realized life. Now, this is not saying anything against, you know, sex or, you know, but it's saying if you think you need to be sexually active to be really fulfilled as a person, you're deceiving yourself. That's not where it lies. I think most people are sexually active. Does the having sex together make your life fulfilling? Or does it make the relationship between the two of you? Hopefully there has to be more than that that's to make the relationship. So as significant as gender is in who you are, your identity ought to lie in being a person and in being loved by God. That's where your identity ought to lie. A friend of mine passed on a little link to a YouTube clip of an Anglican clergyman who was speaking to this assembly of Anglican clergy. And it turns out that he's homosexual in orientation. He tells everyone there that he's homosexual in his orientation. He has been as far back as he can remember. But he decided out of faithfulness to God and to Scripture not to act upon that. And he said, "I thank God that my identity does not lie in my sexual orientation." And time may be, your identity lies in it. If people don't accept that, they're not accepting you. He said, "I thank God that my identity does not lie in that. I thank God that my identity lies in my relationship with Christ. And if I thought that my identity lay in acting on my sexuality, then Christ must have had a less than fulfilled life. Because after all, he never had sex with anyone, so therefore he didn't really have a rich, full life. He lived a deprived life." If we think that about Jesus, no, we're mistaken. And the fact that Jesus is our example, no, our value and our identity ought to lie in that. And even if we forego things which are hard for us to forego, our identity is not shaken. Our identity is in Christ. So as good as sex is in its proper place, being sexually active ought not to be a fundamental part of your identity. Put another way, living a rich and fulfilling life does not depend on engaging in sex. Now, there's a quote from Dorothy Sayers that I find quite interesting. This is talking about your gender identity. "A man once asked me how I manage in my books," she's a very good author, "how I manage in my books to write such natural conversation between men when they were by themselves. Was I by any chance a member of a large mixed family with lots of male friends? I replied that on the contrary, I was an only child and had practically never seen or spoken to any men of my age till I was about 25. "Well," said the man, "I shouldn't have expected a woman," meaning me, "to have been able to make it so convincing. I replied that I had coped with this difficult problem by making my men talk as far as possible like ordinary human beings. This aspect of the matter seemed to surprise the other speaker. He said no more, but took it away to chew it over. One of these days, it may quite rightly occur to him that women, as well as men, when left to themselves, talk very much like human beings also. So sex is important, but that's not where our principal identity lies. Our principal identity lies in our humanity. And yes, there are gender differences, and yes, they could be significant, but much more important is the humanness, the human qualities, the things we share together as human beings. And when a husband and wife can share together as human beings and what they share in common, they'll have slightly different ways in which they nuance things and see things, but nonetheless, they'll share a great deal together. So conclusion, when one gives in to the pleasure of short-term sexual gratification apart from long-term commitment, one is acting contrary to one's long-term well-being and contrary to the long-term well-being of the relationship of the couple. When I've given this talk, say, to a non-Christian audience, I'll say, okay, even if you have followed what I've said and it makes sense to you, I think there's a very good chance that you won't act on what I've just told you. And the reason why you won't act on what I just told you is that you will, at some point, if you're a young person, probably find yourself with a man or a woman, and both of you, if you're not Christians, you don't have any sort of moral sort of constraints about having sex or not, and both of you sort of are open to it. And both of you have a strong drive and desire. I almost guarantee you that your minds at that moment will persuade yourselves that yes, it's right. That we are mature, this is a good thing for us. But I said you need to recognize that the brain, the mind, is very adept in persuading yourself of things that you want. We call it rationalizing. So your mind will tell you that what you want is right and good. In that situation, your desires are very strongly towards having sex, and you like this person. So your brain will tell you, oh, it'll be fine. It'll be good. And even if, strangely, you happen to think of this seminar, which I doubt you would when you're in that kind of situation, you might say, well, that's just statistics. And after all, statistics are statistics, and it's not true of everyone, and I think we can handle this. When I gave the talk in Europe, I gave this talk in northern Sweden. There were about 25 people who were there, maybe only five of whom were Christian. The rest were non-Christians. And given that Sweden, I think most of them are probably sexually active at that point. And several of the questions in the Q&A were around, well, the studies you gave us were with Americans. But what about cross-cultural studies? And I know that what was clicking in the back of their minds was, well, we're Swedes. We're not Americans. And we've been at this longer than you Americans have been at this. And we can handle it, all right? So my response to them, if you think, well, Americans are just guilt-ridden, most young people today who are having sex are not feeling guilt. I mean, some people would. But for many of them, it's not so common the statistics might be different if it were done here in Sweden, but nonetheless, the implications would be the same. Sex early in a relationship is bad for the relationship, and it doesn't matter whether it's just Americans or elsewhere. I should try to look online and see if I find studies done in Europe or elsewhere, which would basically confirm this. But I'm pretty sure the direction would be the same, even if the statistics, the numbers are a little bit different. So I say recognizing this may not be enough to withstand the temptation of the moment. The human mind quite readily justifies to itself action towards which there is strong motivation. So the lesson is, be warned. When sexual attraction is high gear, one's moral deliberations ought not to be trusted. I mean, you won't think that way when you're in the moment, but think that way outside. And recognize that when you're thinking this, if you happen to remember, Peter Payne said, don't trust what your mind is telling you at this point. Because your mind is not trustworthy at this point, given the motivations that you have. Okay, let me stop and we'll have some Q&A for the rest of our time. Yeah.
I was going to say, you were talking about, you know, that moment leading up to oxytocin, which occurs when it's a drug.
It's a hormone, it's a drug within the brain, natural, yes, yes. Well, when you do something that's pleasurable, it feels pleasurable, there's chemistry in your brain behind that, okay?
That's what I'm saying, you can't trust that.
Well, I mean, it's when you have feelings of love, there's chemistry going on there. So it's not as though their emotions don't have any connection with chemistry. But one needs to recognize, apart from what one's intentions were, one didn't intend to have any commitment. The oxytocin is actually not just giving you a pleasurable experience, but actually the oxytocin is developing an emotional bond with the person. And that's the surprising part to many people, that they think they can do it and it'll just be sex for the fun of it. But no, in fact, the oxytocin is developing a bond. Yes? Yeah, earlier on in the cohabitation studies, there was quite a bit of debate amongst the research community, are the results just a selection effect? In other words, the people who are cohabiting, are they people who are more likely to have other things which would cause problems? So maybe the cohabitation isn't actually driving the problems, it's that these people also happen to be people who, and so they've done lots of studies trying to sort those out. And the only ones which really seem relevant are one, age. So if you're 23 compared to 18, you're probably going to be moving into living together and have less negative effects than if you're younger. But then also part of it is the motivation. Why are you moving in with this person? If in fact you have a clear commitment to each other, then there's not a huge negative effect on it. So if you know that you're committed and your marriage is where the direction you're headed, you're thinking you're heading that way, and you both understand that, then living together doesn't have nearly the negative effect that it would have if there's not that commitment to begin with. If you enter into a relationship and both of you are very clear that neither of you want to, marriage is out of the question, there's less negative effect of living together. Now, there's other, I think, negative effects that simply come from having sex, but comparing people who are living together and having sex versus people who are not living together and having sex, they're about the same, right? So what's the difference living together versus... So it appears as though living together there does not have a big effect. But there is a big effect when people are not on the same page, when there's different expectations about where this may lead. When one person's hoping it may lead to marriage, but the other person has no intent of going towards marriage. And even if people enter into it with an agreement, this is not towards marriage, given the bond that develops, in many cases, one of them does begin to say, wish that it will move towards marriage. And the case of the couple that I mentioned where he had, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, I suspect, I don't know, that she was actually hoping more than he would. And with that disparity, the consequences are bad. They're bad for the relationship, bad long-term. And if you go into it to test the relationship, that actually ends up being one of the worst categories because neither of you are sure, neither of you are committed, and you're entering into it to try to decide whether or not you should get married. And that puts the relationship off to a bad start, and the dynamics of that relationship are bad. So there is some selection effect, but at the same time, it's not all selection effect. So they've been trying to weed these things out. It turns out the actual living together and the consequences of living together, when in fact you're not on the same page about why you're living together, has major consequences. Janet?
Of course, expectations, different expectations within marriage have their own problems, although the commitment in marriage, you can work those things out. But so I know you have an answer to this, but if it's working well with a commitment, why get married? What's the biblical reason for Christians to get married?
Yeah, in most cases, people who are living together, they don't get married. But some people just continue to live together. And some countries like Iceland has about the lowest marriage rate of any country in the world. I suspect does not have the lowest single parent rate. So there are quite a few people who just say, why get a marriage license? We don't want to get married, but then unless they live together. And if they stay together and they raise the children together, functionally, they may well be married. I mean, in terms of the what's going on, they don't have a piece of paper. But at the same time, when they don't have the piece of paper, and if they don't have this, sort of, we're committed to each other, then there's this instability just is built into it. And because neither of them has a firm conviction that we're in for this the long term, it's much more apt to fall apart.
No, but the biblical why?
The biblical why?
Why commit?
Okay, well, from a Christian standpoint, marriage is the commitment you're making to one another before God, and it's a relationship in Christ. So you're being united together, not this way, but also a vertical relationship. So one of the biggest differences about marriage from a Christian perspective is this has the vertical dimension as well as the horizontal dimension. You're not just choosing to commit to this other person, you're committed together in Christ, and Christ becomes a key in that the whole dynamic. But were you thinking something else, Janet? Okay. Yeah.
To kind of keep it short, a lot of guys that I know who have fewer sexual partners before being married are more attached to their marriage. And guys who have a lot more sexual partners before being married, even if they're happy in their marriage, I hear this line a lot from guys that I work with. I love my wife, but if she left me, I know I could find another. And those are the guys who have had the most sexual partners before being married. And I don't know if there's a statistical support for that or not, or if that's just been my experience.
Yeah, so they're recording the comment about guys who had sexual relations with a number of people. It becomes less likely they're going to enter into marriage and have a commitment there. So they're married, but they're really not committed to it. There may actually be something in terms of our sort of biochemistry. That it gets sort of warped by all these experiences you have, so it becomes more difficult to actually build the bond. And if a person says, well, I've had sex with lots of people and I don't have an emotional bond to them, I think, well, okay, that actually sounds like bad news for when you get married. Because when you get married, you want to hope that there is this strong emotional bond. If you're not developing an emotional bond with the other people you've been having sex with, there's a significant chance that when you get married, you won't get a very strong emotional bond there. And what's going to happen to, you know, what commitment is there? So, yeah, there's this, for guys and for women, the more sexual partners you have, the worse in terms of the consequences, your ability to enter into a relationship and be the kind of husband or wife that you ought to be. Yes?
Your quote about the virgins and happiness thing, that was kind of intriguing. I just, maybe you said it, I didn't miss it, but they weren't quite as happy. Was there a distinction between whether they were in a relationship or not, although not sexually active, or was it just someone who was a virgin who wasn't in a relationship? Did the studies show that versus...
Yeah, well, virgin means you haven't had sex with anybody, whether it's a man or a woman.
Right.
So therefore, virgins, people who have deprived themselves from being sexually active, they're almost as happy as people who are successfully married, right? So it is true to use statistical studies how they rate happiness. If you're married, that does add to. I mean, it is a bonus. But to think if you don't have that, if you're not married, that somehow you're deprived and you're in the slumps and you can't really expect to have a rich, fulfilled life. And now a rich, fulfilled life does not require that, even though it can add to your relationship. So yeah, being successfully married is a good thing. But if for whatever reason you're not, whether you choose to or not, not being married does not deprive you of having a rich, fulfilled life. Yes?
I have a question. Just in regards to our society today, people are waiting longer and longer before they do get married. Have you seen in any studies, has that been detrimental to our society, waiting longer and longer to get married, or have you
Interesting. The age at which people getting married is going. I think for men it's like for women it's 26 now and 27, 28 for men, so it's much longer until getting married. But it doesn't mean that people are waiting a long time. I mean, I wish we had the problem of people who are actually waiting. But it's a challenge to wait, but they're actually waiting. Some people do, but a lot of people now are choosing not to refrain from having sex. And cohabitation rates going up is sort of a reflection of people don't want to get married yet, but having sex and having sort of these, they want that. So it has effects, but it's not so much the effects of of waiting without having sex. If you wait till you're 28 before you get married, the benefits are equally as great there as if you got married at 24, 23, whatever the case may be. Yeah. Okay, maybe one more question. Oh, by the way, there's a clipboard in the back. If you'd like to have the PowerPoint, I'll send that to you. I'll also send you updates on the ministry I'm involved with. But if you want off out of that, say you don't want that, or you can drop that anytime. Plus, I'll send you an essay that I wrote last week on this topic, which has copious footnotes and statistics and all that kind of stuff within it. Maybe one more question before we go to lunch. Okay, well, thank you very much. Actually, let me pray for us. Lord, I pray that you would help us in our conversation with friends and others, whether they be Christians or not, about the sexual decisions that they make. Lord, I pray that people would be able to look at Christians and be able to see sexuality working the way in which it should work, and be able to see how attractive that is. Lord, I pray that as we talk with non-Christians, that you would be a light through us, and that they would be drawn to what in fact results when people are faithful to you. And Lord, help us to be able to speak to non-Christians and say the Christian ethics is actually just good ethics, period. Lord, help us not to be ashamed or quiet about our Christian sexual standards, but Lord, may it be part of what draws people to yourself. Lord, give us wisdom and grace in all of this. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.